As floodwaters in parts of the Midwest recede, the damage is becoming more clear.
In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore in for David Brancaccio. President Trump has declared a state of disaster in Nebraska, which allows federal assistance to flow to that state as it recovers from devastating flooding. Floodwaters caused an estimated $1.4 billion in damage to that state. More than $500 million worth of damage was to infrastructure, to the state's highways, levees, water treatment facilities. Marketplace's Erica Barris reports that the flood's effects will be with the state for a long time.
Even if Nebraska gets every penny it needs, it will never look the same, according to Mike White with the state's Emergency Management Agency.
Because there are bridges that are gone, there are dams that are gone, there are levees that are gone.
The floodwaters have literally redrawn the map of the state, according to Jenny Campana with the Nebraska Department of Transportation.
The rivers have changed the course of where they flowed before, in some case widened or just changed directions altogether.
When it comes to rebuilding infrastructure after a disaster like this, the process isn't just expensive, it takes a long time. Erwin Redlener with Columbia University's Center for Emergency Management has looked at the long-term effects of disasters. He says even when the money is made available, there are decisions to be made, like whether to build levees and what kind.
So even before we get to the actual building, there will be the political discussions and priority setting that there'll be lots of wrangling about.
Meanwhile, Nebraska officials are expecting more flooding. I'm Erica Barris from Marketplace.
Levi Strauss went public yesterday, and its stock price surged immediately, up 32% on the first day. Now, before a stock goes public, institutional investors get first dibs on buying shares. So for the stock to pop so much is a sign that Levi's shares were very popular among those investors from the get-go, a situation known as being oversubscribed. Eric Gordon is a professor at the University of Michigan's Ross School of Business and joins us. Good morning.
Good morning, Sabri.
So remind us what it means when an IPO is oversubscribed.
Investment bankers go around and check with the usual big institutions that buy the shares and ask them, how many do you think you would buy at what prices? It's oversubscribed when the investors say, we want more than the company is going to sell.
What does this tell us about the nature of the IPO market right now?
Well, the IPO market is pretty healthy, and if you're an investor watching the stock, what it means is, at least on the first day, you should expect a big price bump.
But what does that mean, not for, you know, the institutional investors that get a first crack at buying the stock, but the rest of us who have to wait until the IPO actually happens?
For Sabri, for investors like you and me, it means we buy after the price bump, which means the big guys get some profit up front, you and I buy at a higher price, so we face higher risk.
Eric Gordon, professor at University of Michigan's Ross School of Business. Good to talk to you.
Thank you, Sabri.
I'm Shepard from Lincoln, Nebraska, and I listen to Marketplace several times, actually, every day, because it's got the economic news and developments that are important to me. I donate to Marketplace so that it can be available to everyone, and I hope you'll join me in this effort. Thanks.
To join Shepard as a Marketplace investor, donate online at marketplace.org.
In rare bipartisan agreement, politicians on both sides of the aisle have agreed that we're putting too many people behind bars and spending too much money doing it. One of the key drivers of that at the federal level was the war on drugs that ramped up in the 80s. Since 1980, in fact, our federal prison population has grown by over 600%. Today, nearly half of federal inmates are in for nonviolent drug charges, and about three quarters of them are Black or Hispanic. How we got here is one of the subjects we're tackling in this season of Marketplace's documentary podcast, The Uncertain Hour. The Uncertain Hour's host, Chrissy Clark, is here with more. Welcome.
Hey, Sabri.
So, Chrissy, the war on drugs ramped up in the 80s in the midst of the crack crisis, and that was almost four decades ago. So how did that affect who's in prison today and how long they are there for?
The very short answer is crack cocaine was very much painted as a black drug by politicians and the media in the 1980s. Mandatory minimum sentences passed into law in the 80s gave people caught with crack cocaine much more severe sentences than people caught with powder cocaine. And some of those policies are beginning to be rolled back. Congress has somewhat reduced the federal sentencing disparities between crack and powder cocaine. But one of the things I learned in my research is that the racial dynamics at play during the crackdown on crack they've been visible in our country for more than a century, and economics plays a part. I spoke to a drug policy historian named Donna Murch, who put it like this.
The way the narrative of drugs is mobilized is often to racial ends in the United States.
So one of the earliest examples of this is opium. In 1875, San Francisco passed one of the nation's first ever drug laws, a ban on smoking opium. But weirdly, injecting opium or swallowing it was still allowed. Historians like Murch point out that opium smoking was the method preferred by Chinese immigrants who faced decades of discrimination in the U.S. and were seen as an economic threat by many whites. And then there's this similar story with cocaine, which wasn't criminalized until 1914 when it started getting associated with Black Americans. That was happening right as African Americans were being seen as an economic threat to white workers post-emancipation. So what happened with crack, many historians argue it's just one example in a long line of drug scares that are being mobilized to racial ends.
What about opioids today? I mean, how does race play into our current epidemic?
So the opioid epidemic has, as you know, mostly been associated with white people, and the rhetoric and policies have been less punitive, more focused on treatment. And yet there are many people of color who are affected by the opioid crisis. In fact, in an urban area like D.C., most of the people dying of opioid overdoses are African Americans. And some communities are starting to speak out and saying they're not getting the same public health attention that folks in white suburban and rural areas are.
Uncertain Hour host and senior correspondent Chrissy Clark, been a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you so much, Sabri.
The new season of the podcast, The Uncertain Hour, is out now. Subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.